Scott, Wyatt Scotland, and things of that sort. First, I wanted to do something that teachers always do. I had a few visual aids, but I don't want you to get spaghetti on. In fact, I had a tie on earlier and spilled something all the way down the front of it, so I went, sorry. But anyway, I had some pictures around, and you can take a look at some of those. The Edinburgh Castle, and the one on this table is the one that I like. That one is what is called the Consecration Cross. Hold that up. I like that. That's called a Consecration Cross. And what happens is that when temples are being built, things like the Roslyn Chapel that you saw in the movie, the Da Vinci Code, when temples are being built, the priests come around and they sprinkle holy water on the walls. And then the masons come by and they insert these crosses in the walls. Thus, to consecrate the building requires consecration crosses to be put in. Anyway, too exciting. And there are a few other things. There's a picture of the castle of Edinburgh and a few things like that. I also wanted to mention a couple of books, too. And stand by. I want you to see these. Touch them with your own hands and so on. So hold on a second.
Yeah.
Here too. Yeah, one more. Yeah. Many long years ago, I was at Baylor, teaching the philosophy of art and so on, and I taught that for all my 43 or 46 years there, depends on how you count. And I got to the point that I sort of needed something else. And I went to downtown Waco, insofar as there is a downtown Waco, that has something to do with the 53 tornado, but nonetheless, that's another story. But I found something that isn't there anymore called the Waco Bookstore, and I bought three books, those three, and you'll notice they all belong to the same person, a girl named Jenny Cassaday, spelled funny, C-A-S-S-E-D-A-Y, and she was from Bullitt County, Kentucky, and since I'm from Kentucky, that sort of interested me, and Bullitt County, Kentucky is just below Louisville, Kentucky. And she went to something called the Louisville Female Seminary. And by the way, would you pass these around to anybody who wants one? I have a list. Oh, wait. See if I make sure I have one.
No. Well, let's just give you one.
Yeah, give you
make
one.
Make sure you have one.
Okay.
Pass them around.
All right, now we're set. What I wanted to do was to give you a kind of agenda of where we're going and what we're going to do with this. First, these three books had all belonged to the same girl. And she had gone to college at something called the Louisville Female Seminary between the years, at least I know these, of 1868 in 1870. You notice that if you look at those books that the earliest date is 1868, and she has in one of them in the back the graduating class from 1870, and she lists the people who graduated there. And the interesting thing about it is that all three of the books, well, two things. One is they're all Scottish. And secondly, they illustrate a trend in the way Scottish philosophy affected America. From the very first, American philosophy was Scottish. That is, there was a very, very, very strong Scottish influence. So that the major philosophers were under that influence until about 1867. And the date is by no means arbitrarily chosen, but more on that alone. But anyway. And they illustrate a trend, as I said. First, what we did was simply import Scottish works. And you'll notice the one book which is the best bound of the three, but it's also, the problem is, in Waco we have a very good store called the Library Binding Company. And the people do beautiful work. The only problem is the guys who do it can't read. And you'll notice that on the outside, they put some very strange things on this book. It doesn't come out well at all. But what it is a copy of the lectures on rhetoric and belles-lettres by a man named, lost it for a moment. It's on there. Hugh Blair. Yeah, Hugh Blair, who was the preacher at the High Kirk of St. Giles. And the book was first published in 1783. So it was simply taken verbatim. Sometimes parts of it were published, but usually the entire book. The next step was we started publishing abridgments. And you'll notice that the one that I left with the original binding is a copy of a book by a man named Henry Hume, Lord Kames, who was also a sort of minor blog. And he published The Elements of Criticism in three very fat volumes. And nobody is going to force a bunch of students to read in one turn three very fat volumes. So this was a bridge. And the abridgment, to read the introduction, is an absolute butchery. He actually put in not only what he thinks is the best of Kames, but he took out parts that he thought, some that he thought were indelicate, and others that he thought he could improve upon. He took those out and put in what he thought was better stuff. But at any rate, it's a butchery. So next we abridged. And then finally, Americans began doing their own books. And you'll find that red one is by a man named Francis Haven, who taught first at Amherst and later at a school that I imagine developed into the University of Chicago. But at any rate, Haven was completely Scottish in his teaching. If you look at the references in the back of the book, all of them are Scottish. At least about the first five every time. He mentioned all the subjects, and he thinks the Scots got it right in every case. It's really amazing. But anyway, most of the American schools, the early ones, were religious, as you know. We were arguing at one table about whether or not you need a religious background to make things work. And apparently the early Americans felt that you did, because most of our, almost all of that, and I'm being careful in saying almost, of our schools were religion-based, church-related, so. And this went right across the country. And this tended to be Scottish almost every time. Therefore, they were opposing most of the time the work of the most famous Scot of all of them, David Hume. So I mentioned on here the work of David Hume, and I wanted to make sure that you spelled it right, H-U-M-E. And by the way, one small thing that you might be interested in knowing, at least you can carry away one fact from this lecture. One thing that, by golly, I didn't know, now it might be nice to have that. This word, Hume, I don't know whether you follow politics enough to do this, but there was a well-known politician recently whose name was Sir Alec Douglas Hume, and he spelled it H-O-M-E, H-O-M-E. And as a matter of fact, this was the proper spelling in Scotland. And most of the members of that family, including Henry Hume, who became Lord Thames, spelled it H-O-M-E. There was also a, I think it was George Hume, who did plays, as well as preached, by the way, and he got in trouble for doing both. But he spelled it H-O-M-E. But when David Hume had to go to work for a living, and he went down to Bristol, and in Bristol he had to work for some kind of a retail firm, and he found that if he wanted those Englishmen to call him Hume rather than Home, he had to spell it H-U-M-E, so he changed the spelling. So if you wonder, why does he spell it H-U-M-E while all those other guys spell it the wrong way? They got it right. He's spelling it differently. He's doing it. Anyway, they were usually writing against him, and you know the reason why. Hume is known in philosophy as the great skeptic. The great skeptic. That is, normally, you are taught Hume in a course that will teach you about Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. And the way it goes is something like this. Locke seemed to have believed that you could know just everything empirically. Berkeley also said that you could know everything empirically, or at least everything that you knew empirically. But the trouble, Berkeley said, was if you know only empirically, that is, by perception, all that you know in the end is perceptions. That is, you cannot prove that there's anything outside of the knowing agent corresponding to those perceptions. It may be that there's just perceptions, and you hope that they'll come to you in an orderly manner. In case you're not up on this, one of the best short discussions that I've seen is a poem by Bertrand Russell. And it goes something like this. Russell wrote in his History of Philosophy, he said, a man once said, God must find it exceedingly odd when he finds that the tree continues to be when there's no one about in the plot. And there's a response to this by Berkeley, I think. And the response goes, sir, your question is odd, for I am always about in the fog. And that's why the tree continues to be, for it's observed respectfully God. That is, Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley, believed that you couldn't prove that there's anything outside of us corresponding to those perceptions. But God exists as the sort of eternal, consistent perceiver. He's always there. Well, Hume came along and said that it is true that we know everything that we know by perception. But there's just a whole lot that we can't know that way. We can't know that causes continue to have effects of the same type, time after time. He wrote a famous question, will the future be like the past? And he said, you don't know that. That is, it may be that you've grown up, and several times you've seen stupid people like this old man walk out in front of cars speeding down the highway, and they've been squashed. But you don't know that this will happen tomorrow. It may be that this old guy will step out in front of a speeding car, and he will get up smiling. Gosh, that was nice. You don't know that the same thing will happen. Because all you know is what you perceive. And you can't perceive that something will follow necessarily. Thus, you can't prove that the future will be like the past. He was very skeptical. Now, this led, we're finally getting to our subject. Took me only half an hour to do that. We're finally getting to our subject. Common sense in America. The leader of the common sense philosophy was a man named Thomas Reed, R-E-I-D, Reed. And something else that you ought to know that I didn't write on here. He was born in a little town above Aberdeen. And the little town is spelled, I wish I had a blackboard, it's spelled S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N. S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N. And I wanted for years to call that Strachan or something. But if you go there, the people call it strong. Now how you get strong out of S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N, I'll never know. But the Scots do strange things when they did that. Anyway, he was born there in 1710, a year earlier than you. And he lived longer, too. He died in 1796, long after Hume was gone. But he wrote, finally, a book. And by the way, it arose out of a group like this. One of the reasons that I came tonight was that philosophy may have begun in the Western world as we know it by somebody in the street, this old man, Socrates, who spent his time wandering and people would follow him and he would ask questions of people that they couldn't answer. And this was embarrassing and you like to see important people embarrassed. So he gathered a following. But in later centuries, philosophy was advanced by groups like this, by clubs. There was in Edinburgh the Select Society, for example. In Aberdeen, there was the Aberdeen Philosophical Society. There were all sorts of these all over, and they advanced the cause. In fact, the Scottish philosophy of common sense, which revolutionized philosophy both in America and in France as well as Britain, was born in the Aberdeen Philosophical Society. Old Thomas Reed, he was nearing 50 by the time he left up there. And he began to teach at one of the colleges in Aberdeen. Actually, something else the Scots are proud of. The Scots have a way of saying that, they used to say at least back in the 19th century, the 18th, that England has two great universities, Cambridge and Oxford, and Aberdeen has two, King's and Marshall. England has two, Aberdeen has two. And what they were saying, of course, is that England has only two. But the Scots have universities all over the place. They're in Glasgow, Aberdeen, now there's one in Stirling, the big one in Edinburgh, St. Andrews, all over. They believed in a more democratic style. They believed that everybody should go to college if they could possibly absorb it. And they tried to find a way to do this. And that goes back to, well, enough of that. But Thomas Reed taught first at King's College, Aberdeen. And then in 1864, he moved over to Glasgow and began teaching at the University of Glasgow. There's a quotation that I have to read to you. It's a very short one, so I won't bore you too much. But he wrote his first book, Reed did, in 1764. And in that book, the book was entitled An Inquiry into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common Sense. An Inquiry into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common Sense. And he said this, He said, taking all these propositions together, I think, I am conscious. Everything thinks exists. I exist. Then he says, would not every sober man form the same opinion of the man who seriously doubted any one of them? And if he was his friend, would he not hope for his cure from physic and good regimen rather than from metaphysics and logic? I like that. What he's saying is this. Suppose someone came to you and they said, you know, I'm not sure I exist. Or, I'm not sure I have a mind. Or, I'm not sure that I'm a thinking being. What would you say to that person? Reed says what you would say is, take two of these and come back tomorrow. Or as he puts it, we would recommend physic and good regimen rather than metaphysics and logic. You know, take two of these, you'll feel better. Or if that doesn't get to you, let me try one of them. There's a story that I heard once. Supposedly it was true, if that matters. But from Ohio State, there was a teacher up there who taught psychology. And he also worked over in the, what we used to call an insane asylum. I imagine they have politer names now. But anyway, worked over there too. And one day, one of the patients came in and he said, the man's name, teacher's name was Murphy. He said, Dr. Murphy, he said, I don't know what you do with dead people, but do it. I'm dead. And Murphy thought first that he might talk him out of it by saying, well, do you mean that things are not quite like they were? You don't have the influence that you once had. Or, I'm awfully tired lately. I'm dead, or something. Or, you know, metaphorically, something like that. No, he meant dead. He said, no, I mean dead, really dead. And again, I don't know whether it calls for burial or what. And Murphy said, well, look, let me try something on you. He said, dead people don't bleed, do they? And the guy said, what do you mean they don't bleed? Well, if a person is alive, they have a heart that's pumping. And it pumps the blood out, right? If they were dead, the blood might sort of seep out. But they wouldn't bleed in the way that people who are alive are. So there's a sense in which dead people don't bleed, right? And the man looked back across the desk and he said, yeah, I guess that's true. And Murphy reached into his desk and he pulled out a pen and he reached across and he poked the guy in the back of the hand and blood spurted out. And he said, now what do you think? And the man looked down at the blood spurting out of his hand and he said, I was wrong. They do bleed. You know, there's nothing you can say. Now, let's go back to something else that I could teach you. When Thomas Reed says in the Philosophy of Common Sense that you don't have to deal with somebody who questions his own existence or questions the cause and effect relation or whatever, what do you do with somebody like that? Is he saying, really, that David Hume was nuts, that he was crazy? Better than I did. No, he isn't saying that. What's the difference, really, between Thomas Reed and David Hume? I can assure you that David Hume, he was a terribly fat man, as you probably know, horribly obese, but probably been eating a year. But he was a terribly fat guy, but he would have dodged those carriages like everybody else. You know, he would have known that people get flattened by them. And he thought, by habit, you come to recognize that you're going to get yourself killed if you run out in front of them. And he thought, you have to believe that. It's sort of built into your mind. But the point is, that doesn't make it true or necessary. He said the word necessary applies only to logic, really. Bertrand Russell said the same thing. Mathematics. You can say, if this is the case and this is the case, it follows necessarily that. But in the factual world, things are probable, not necessary. So you can't prove anything follows necessarily. And the difference between Reed and Hume early was, Reed thought that there are certain things that you have to accept as true. And they are true. You have to accept that you exist, that you have a body, that you're a thinking being, and so on. And that proves these things are true. Hume thought, maybe you are sort of built, so you've got to accept these things. But that doesn't make them true, or force them to be true. Well, later on, Reed retired from teaching at the ripe old age of 70. But he didn't quit. And he published two more books. One on what he called the intellectual powers, epistemology, psychology too, really. They weren't divided in those days. He published a book on the intellectual powers in 1785. And then in 1788, he published a book on the active powers, on morals or ethics, in other words. And two things we should add quickly. One is, this way of divvying up the subject became standard. After 1828, it became standard everywhere, including the United States. You can go down to, you know, I'm not recommending it, but you can go down to College Station and visit the Rudder Tower there and look at their first faculty. And you'll notice that the first president was listed as president and professor of these two subjects, the intellectual on one side, the moral on the other. And most, or a lot of college presidents would write two books. One of them would be on either ethics, morals, the active powers, that side. The other one would be on the intellectual powers, the mental powers, whatever. Two books. And by the way, something else you should know. Whenever you're writing a paper or something in philosophy, always use two books. If you use one book, that's plagiarism. But if you use two books, that's research. Now, back to where I was. In the later books, Reed changed his strategy. He didn't change his position. He still believed, by golly, you've got to start somewhere. If you're going to argue with somebody, you've got to, I've got to stop eventually. You've got to start somewhere. You've got to start with something. And he thought that in every subject, whether we're talking about math, ethics, anything, there are certain things that you've got to take for granted. And if you don't, you can't proceed at all. You know, you've got to have certain axioms in the geometry that you just accept. And once you accept those, you go on from there. So that's common sense, he thought. But later on, and this is what makes him a very modern-looking philosopher, later on he began tying this to language. And I've listed a couple of things here that I wanted you to see. Imagine, and when I was a student, we thought this was so very clever. And we attached it to some very modern philosophers. I didn't know anything about Thomas Reed. I never heard of him until the 1970s. And I was taking courses in ethics in the 50s. Anyway, what we thought was terribly clever imagine one. Suppose you are talking about some gorgeous girl, and you say, she's gorgeous, and she also has a high moral standard. Suppose someone says that. She's gorgeous, and she has a high moral standard. And someone replies, no, you don't. That would seem a funny, sort of non-responsive thing, wouldn't it? But, Reed says, if Hume were right, that's what we would say. Because Hume says, and I'm, well, I wasn't going to read you this one, but I will, since I happen to have it right here. In the Principles of Morals, you remember, Hume said this. He said, the hypothesis which we embrace is plain. It maintains that morality is determined by sentiment, what you like, and it determines virtue to be whatever mental action or quality gives to the spectator the pleasing sentiment of approbation, and vice the contrary. We then proceed to examine a plain matter of fact in which these actions agree, and thence endeavor to extract some general observations with regard to these sentiments. And then he says, if you call this metaphysics and you find anything abstruse here, you may only conclude that your turn of mind is not suited to the moral sciences. That is, if this sounds way out to you, don't major in philosophy. And by the way, if you couldn't hear that, take that free and for nothing. Read it on there. That's what he says. So, Hume said, we know something is virtuous because it triggers in us the pleasing sentiment of approbation. Now, suppose you wanted to argue with somebody. How would you argue with them? Well, on Hume's account, when I say, this girl is gorgeous, and she has a high moral character. What I'm saying is, you know, I like this girl, and I like what she does. I'm very much in favor of this. And if you wanted to argue with someone who says, I like this, what you might say is, no, you don't, not really. And Reed replies to that with two things that I won't read to you. He says, first, there is no rule of language by which you can translate the first sentence into the second. That is, the sentence, this girl is gorgeous and she has a high moral character, is clearly about the girl. I'm saying something about the girl. It isn't about me in the way I feel. And if you want to disagree with me, fine, you can do that. I mean, I would tell you, I do think she has a high moral character. Now, maybe she does some things that you think violate the rules, but nonetheless, you know, that's the way it is. Nevertheless, I think she's quite a decent person. That's the way you would argue with her. And there would be nothing for me to take offense about there, would there? That's what Reed says. That is, you're free to disagree with me or anybody. But if you tell me that I don't really like something that I just told you I did like, you're accusing me of lying, aren't you? And that does raise an offense, doesn't it? I know what I like, don't I? And who are you to tell me what I like and what I don't? But nonetheless, it would sound very strange, wouldn't it, if someone said, she's gorgeous, and she also has a high moral character, and someone responded by saying, no, you don't. But if Hume were right, that's what we would say, if you want to disagree with me. And there's a second one that I like, too, that I don't have on most of your sheets, and that is, suppose someone said, in a good Baptist way, you might say, because of my Adamic nature, I cannot help liking pornography. I like it. I find it appealing. Damn it all. I find it appealing, but I don't approve of it. Now, does it make sense to say, I like it, but I don't approve of it? On Hume's account, it wouldn't make any sense, would it? It wouldn't, because liking and approving are the same thing. Reed has a whole chapter in the Active Powers in which he argues approving always requires judgment. It's a funny thing that in the 20th century, J.O. Urmson wrote a paper which some of you may have read, and I recommend it to others, called On Grading. Have you read that, On Grading? It's wonderful. He does something that I think is hilarious. You won't, but I'll mention it anyway. What he does, he was British, you know, and he wrote away to the British equivalent of the Department of Agriculture, and he got a list of standards for grading apples. And it's kind of funny. Good apples are kind of bad, really. They're way down the scale. And then they have fancy apples, and the best are extra fancy. And there's a long list of criteria that apples must satisfy in order to be graded as extra fancy. And you can imagine somebody, you know, had a sort of treadmill going across with apples, you know, going across this, and he's picking them and putting them in the appropriate crates and so on. And he follows the criteria and puts them in. Now, if Hume were right, this guy would be in a kind of, pardon the expression, but kind of perpetual orgy. He'd be saying, wow, extra fancy, you know, grabbing this one, putting it in the next, wow. And then he'd get to the next one, oh, good. Because grading them would involve this kind of liking and being, but grading, I can tell you after all my years, can be a pretty dull affair, can't it? I can say, this is very good paper, but I get tired. You know, it really wears you down after a while. But nevertheless, good does not seem to involve liking at all. I could say, for example, that I can imagine a lot of people writing good papers on Nietzsche, but, or worse yet, Heidegger. But I can't imagine liking one of them because I hate Heidegger and Nietzsche and so on. But nonetheless, that only indicates that grading and calling something good is not the same as liking it. I can even approve it. Approve this person. But anyway, moral sense. Now, I promised you that I'd throw in a bit about Texas. And I'll do it. One of the things that I want to underscore, and by the way, this is not a sales pitch. I admit the reason that I wanted you to put your address on there, it doesn't have anything to do with buying a book. I don't care whether you buy it or not. I don't get much in the way of royalties, if anything, from that. But besides that, I'm the salesman. The general editor said that my book is probably the most needed of the series and will sell less than any of the others because nobody's ever heard of the people that I'm talking about in the book. But they should. It's important. But nonetheless, I had a book some years ago that I did, and I just happened to have a copy here. And this one, well, you can have a book. This is a book on a man named William Terry Crane. And it's not a great book, or it may be not even a good book. But it has one thing in it that's important, and only one. And that is, William Terry Crane was born in Virginia, Baptist, naturally. And he was born into a fairly well-to-do family. So he could be, he could go to school just about anywhere he wanted. He was born near Richmond, so he went to a little school, which is now the University of Richmond. And then his father moved to Maryland because he was afraid that a bunch of Roman Catholics were moving in there, and that scared him. So he wanted to make sure they didn't affect the nation's capital. So he moved to Maryland and sent his son to what was then called Columbian College. And it's now George Washington University. He also went for a couple of years, and I think most of his work was really done up there, to a college in Hamilton, New York, which is now Colgate. In his day, it was called the Hamilton Literary and Theological Institution. He went to these, and this guy put everything on paper and saved it all. So we know where he went to school, who his teachers were, what subjects he took, what textbooks were used in those subjects. And in many cases at Baylor, we have the books, the very books that he used in the 1830s. We've got them. And if you look, you can find that everywhere he went, he was taught the Scottish philosophy of common sense. Everywhere. And when he began teaching himself, he was teaching and preaching first in Alabama, and then in Georgia, and then down in Louisiana, and then finally in 1863, he moved over to Texas and began teaching at Baylor, and taught at Baylor, which was then down in Independence, Texas, from 1863 until 1885. And you can bet that the sort of philosophy he taught was Scottish. The first, we also know, and there are arguments about who started what school first and so on, but we also know that the first professor of moral philosophy at the University of Texas, a man named Robert Louis Dabney, D-A-B-N-E-Y. Robert Louis Dabney, he was hired to teach moral philosophy there in 1883. And he taught the Scottish philosophy complete. You can still get his work on practical philosophy, and it's Scottish through and through. So this was taught everywhere, and in Texas as well. And by the way, one other thing nearby, and with this I'll give it up. But one final thing. Some years ago, I went to a meeting at Ouachita up in Arkansas. And Ouachita is one of the older schools. It was back to the 1870s, I guess, up there. 1870s, around 1880. And it's Baptist too, of course. But I wondered what kind of philosophy they taught at Ouachita in the 19th century. And it used to be the case when these schools started, most of them started in the 19th century. They would put in their catalogs not only what courses were taught and who taught them, but they would also put in there what textbooks were used. And the reason they would do this is they wanted you to know that they weren't doing Sunday school stuff. This was serious philosophy, you know, it was important. So I went to the library at Ouachita, and I found the head librarian, and I asked, could you please dig out some of your earliest catalogs in the 1880s? And she said, well, we got them on microfilm, why do you want to see them? And I said, well, I wanted to see them because in the early days, a lot of schools would put in their catalogs what courses were taught and what books were used, and I'm kind of interested in that subject, and I want to see if they were using Scottish philosophy. And she said rather gruffly, we didn't do that. And I said, well, I don't mind. I wonder if I could see them anyway, you know, it might be fun just to have a look. And finally she said, well, I'll dig out the microfilm for you and hook up the machine, but we didn't do that. And she hooked it up for me. And it turns out they did do that. And if you look at a page taken out of their catalogs from about 1889, it's Scottish all the way. Logic. The book they used was by a man at Princeton, the only book he ever wrote, named Lyman Atwater. And Lyman Atwater taught the Princeton theology, and it was Scottish all the way. In things like political economy, they would use, well, they used Gregory to some degree, but they also used a lot of Scottish works. Sir William Hamilton was in there, and all the other Scottish authors, time after time. So it was used across the South. And also, you could say the same about the Midwest. But Texas was completely dominated by the Scottish philosophy all the way. And a lot of the best work is, and this is the good news that I leave with you, a lot of the best work was done in periodicals. And until very recently, these periodicals, 19th century stuff, if they existed at all, were practically in a vault in the library. You had no chance. Now you can bring them up on your desktop if you have a computer. They're right there. All you have to do is hit a couple of points with the mouse and you got them. There it is. It's available as it never was before. And my hope is that as we get into the 21st century, we'll come to see that there was some very good stuff done on the 19th, too. And we'll start to dig into it. Thank you very much.
All right. Can you take some questions?
Yeah. Anything else you want to know? I know.
All right, let's go ahead and take some questions. We have one right here.
Yeah, what you got?
It is, you call Hume and Berkeley the idealists.
No, I didn't mean to say that. No.
It's my understanding that it's that instead. Okay. No. And it's said that Immanuel Kant, rescued philosophy from the idealists. Now, to what extent and how does Reid relate to Kant and to Kant's teaching?
Well, first, to be honest, Kant knew about Reid, and I'm not sure that Reid ever read Kant, frankly. Yes. But Kant read Reid, and people followed him, including Priestley. And he didn't like it, and he was very critical. He didn't like this sort of thing at all. He thought it was much too easy. He thought that here are people who are suddenly claiming to know by the sheer light of common sense things that I went to a lot of effort to figure out. And he didn't go for it. But you're right. The way Kant, of course, and this is notorious, it isn't new with me, the way Kant supposedly unified these two was he claimed, and this is my language more than his, he claimed that the mind is like a kind of filing cabinet. And it's kind of nice to have a filing cabinet with files, but they're pointless unless there's something in them, right? And empiricism puts the stuff in there, you see. So what he claimed was that, how does he put it, that concepts without percepts are empty, percepts without concepts are blind. I think that's the way it goes. But honesty prevails at the end. If you actually read Kant, you'll find the idealists win every time. So he does claim, and people who teach Kant try to claim, well, there's kind of balance here, you know, balanced the idealism of Descartes, Leibniz, and Spinoza with the empiricism of Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. And to some degree he did, but really, reading and the idealist win every time. Because he was brought up, taught Leibniz, Baumgartner, an idealist, Baumgartner, Wolf, and other idealists. Is that there?
Thank you. Next question, over here.
Yeah. You know, there was another Scotsman who was influential in the United States, especially in the South, and that was Sir Walter Scott.
Yeah.
Okay. Was he versed in the philosophy of Scotland?
Yes, I would think so. He wasn't primarily a philosopher, obviously. But the one thing that you might find that's kind of philosophical is also kind of pseudo-philosophy. I'm not sure this is making sense, but what I mean is this. If you look at his novels, one thing you could say about them is that they, if you want to characterize his novels, one way you might characterize them is something like picturesque. That is, they seem to conjure up a lot of themes and backgrounds and so on. And the picturesque was really brought into the philosophy of art by a man named Archibald Alison, who was an Anglican, actually, who lived in Edinburgh. So he was a kind of transplanted to Scotland. But it isn't the Scottish philosophy of common sense.
Yeah. We have one over here.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about the influence of language, philosophy, and theory in the 20th century?
Yeah, you could do that all day. Because what happened in the 20th century, of course, is that you had a number of people who, beginning with Wittgenstein, Wittgenstein, Russell, and Moore, who began to feel that we can solve all the philosophical problems by examining language. And the problem was, in a way, they couldn't agree on how this was supposed to go. That is, there were some of them. And the best example of this is Russell and Whitehead's Principia Mathematica, which was in 1906, this huge. By the way, one small thing that I might tell you. If I'm not mistaken, the Principia Mathematica is made up of three big volumes about this thick. And somebody, I think the Mentor Books, got out a paperback, Principia Mathematica 2, section 56, which is about this big. Because they figured that's as much as most of us will understand anyway. You know, and it's probably true. But what they tried to do was to and this was also what Heywood R. Schuford of Baylor University tried to do, was to do a philosophy on the model of mathematics. That is, to do a kind of picture theory, to understand language as a kind of picture of the world. And this is, people who are into this more than I, also what Wittgenstein tried to do in his first book, it has this long term title. But yeah, it's called the Tractatus, the Tractatus Logico Mathematicus, that one is, but the shorthand version is the Tractatus. But he later came himself to feel that this wouldn't cut it. And some people say that what happened to Wittgenstein was that Wittgenstein, and it's funny we're meeting here, met an Italian. And the Italians, which are guys from Italy, were talking, and they were just the way Italians do talk with their hands. And I guess someone challenged him, could you put that into a mathematical formula? So he thought, if we're going to really understand language or to understand how philosophy works, what we need to do is look at language and try to kind of dissolve our problems. You know, once we really know what we mean when we say, we will the problems will just disappear. And then there are others. These were typically called the ideal language boys. And in contrast with those, you have the ordinary language boys. in the ordinary language types, like J.L. Austin. Austin thought that the way you use language philosophically is to not to dissolve the problems so much as to solve them by using language. And he said, for example, and this is, I think, the best short piece that I've seen is in an essay that he wrote called The Plea for Excuses. He said that freedom properly understood, and this is why I say ordinary language, let's not try to do math, or not try to do symbolic logic. Let's try to look at what the guy on the street means when he says. That if you actually look at freedom, for example, you will find that freedom is not a positive term requiring elucidation, but rather a negative term. That is, to say that someone had acted freely is to say that he acted not unfreely. That is, when you say, he gave that confession freely, that means we didn't beat him up, you know, or something. He just wanted to confess, and he did. Or, since my wife worked as a medical technologist, suppose you knew about a girl who was getting married, John married, you know, married, and you wondered, is he marrying her of his own free will? And how would you answer that? Well, you'd ask her, and she would say, I did a pregnancy test on Mary. She's not pregnant, therefore, you know, it wasn't a shotgun wedding. He didn't have to marry her. He just wanted to marry her, and he did. It wasn't a forced thing. So, the point that I'm trying to get at in my usual sloppy fashion is that there are a number of different ways that have been used in the 20th century looking at language to talk about ranging.
And was all of that in Reed? I mean, which one was Reed's?
Reed, I think, was closer to J.L. Austin, actually. That is, Reed was closer to what we actually say. When he says, for example, regarding this case of, you know, the one that I used is almost his, saying that the girl's gorgeous and she has a high moral character. Reed says, there is no rule of language that I know of by which this could be translated into. There he's looking at ordinary language. He's saying, we just can't do that. Yeah. Okay, so I think it's probably closer to
J.L.
Austin.
Okay, we have a question right here.
Yeah,
I guess in daily life, there are certain things.
Thanks, professor.
There are certain things we experience that need no proof. I guess they're commonsensical, yeah. Right? Things that are so basic that need no proof.
Right.
Is that basically what the Scottish common sense philosophy is saying, or is it building a little bit more on top of that?
Yeah, and no, it is that. And the problem, you can see, Baptists and Presbyterians, too, came to feel that, Presbyterians came to feel that the shorter and longer catechism were simply the dictates of common sense, naturally. And what you believe is commonsensical. So the one way that philosophers have of saying this is that if you permit intuitions into a system, they tend to proliferate uncontrollably. And they do. That is, you end up with more common sense things than you want. And that's not a problem.
But
Reed did not.
But isn't that a very simplistic view of life? If you just look at the commonsensical stuff and you don't...
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But, nevertheless, it is a good response, a good place to begin, at least. And I think if you carry this further, as Reed did, into language and things like this, you can get some interesting things on.
David?
Yeah.
If I heard correctly, you made reference to an event in 1867 that changed the predominance.
Yes, and you know what that was. That was the publication, for the first time, of the Journal of Speculative Philosophy. The Journal of Speculative Philosophy was published by a group known as the St. Louis Hegelians, and it was devoted entirely to, or not entirely, but mostly to German transcendentalist, and so on, philosophy. And this became the age of Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, all those guys. And it is true that German philosophy was pervasive at the end of the 19th century and in the start of the 20th. The language philosophers, people like Russell and G.E. Moore and even J.L. Austin, were replying first to the German philosophers, people like Heidegger. Yeah, but that was the change. And that's where it started. Of course, the thing is, changes like this don't happen overnight. And as a result, even when John Dewey went to the University of Vermont in somewhat later times, in his first publications were in the Journal of Speculative Philosophy. But in the Schelp volume on Dewey, he writes about the bare bones of Scott's thought. He was taught at the University of Vermont. So this was still being taught in law schools, you know, very late in the century. But sort of the bell was tolling in 1867. That may have been.
Any questions? Anybody back over there, yeah. Carl?
Some of the things you said early on about starting from a standpoint of common sense thinking sounds almost Cartesian. I wonder if there's a Cartesian connection in Scottish philosophy.
If so, they wouldn't admit it, because they would claim that you shouldn't have to prove that you exist. And it shouldn't be. Cogito ergo sum isn't necessary. You don't need the ergo there at all. If you're a thinking being, then obviously you exist. You don't have to go through all this painstaking work that Descartes did. I see what you mean. But Green wouldn't have liked it, and it did. You know it all.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.